Welcome to the Jihadology Podcast. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Aaron Zellin, founder of Jihadology.net.
And I'm Carl Morand, the show's producer. This episode features an interview with Catherine Zimmerman, a research fellow at the American Enterprise Institute and the lead analyst on Al-Qaeda for AEI's Critical Threats Project. She specializes in Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula and Al-Shabaab.
In this episode, we talked about AQAP since the death of Anwar al-Awlaki and the group's withdrawal from territory in southern Yemen in the summer of 2012, the effect of the rise of the Houthis and how the Saudi-Emirati war in Yemen has affected AQAP, AQAP's local outreach and how it is similar or different to what it tried in 2011 and 2012, how its leaders getting droned has affected the organization, and what the Islamic State is up to in Yemen and what it means for AQAP.
And after the interview, we'll have an updated hashtag social media segment covering postings from September 17th through the 27th.
Last time people were paying attention to Yemen and AQAP, I'd argue, was maybe around fall 2011 when Anwar al-Awlaki was killed in a drone strike. And maybe for those a little bit more niche, the summer of 2012 when AQAP was kicked out of the villages and cities in southern Yemen. At the time, obviously, people started paying more attention to Syria with the rise of foreign fighters, Jabhat al-Nusra, later ISIS. But things were, of course, still happening in Yemen. It's not as if they just stopped there. They stopped the jihad. So with that said, just to briefly, fill in that time gap to what's been going on more recently, could you describe sort of what AQAP's activities in Yemen were up to and what they're up to between the summer of 2012 and, say, the summer of 2014, when we really started to notice AQAP beginning to once again pick up its overt military activities beyond just assassinations?
What we saw after AQAP was pushed out of South Yemen was a little bit of a reset mode. AQAP reconsolidated in its more historical safe havens in eastern Yemen and then returned to some of the activities that it was pursuing in 2010. So that would be targeting the Yemeni military. There was a concerted campaign to go after Yemeni military headquarters and also intelligence headquarters in south and east Yemen. And then, as you mentioned, the assassinations campaign. So this is to degrade the quality of the political security officers, intelligence collectors, going after AQAP. Much of those activities were oriented on simply degrading the quality of the Yemeni military, which at the time was really the only force fighting AQAP besides the occasional U.S. airstrike. And then, of course, trying to break the will of the Yemeni soldiers to fight. That's something that AQAP has really pushed hard. They're not trying to defeat the Yemeni military, but simply to break the will of soldiers to fight for a Yemeni government. I think that's been accomplished today.
Yeah, definitely. And as you sort of alluded to, at the time, they're specifically focused on the Yemeni military and state and security apparatus. But over time, obviously, the Houthis have become a larger target for them. If you look at least the statistics of the operations that they're putting out themselves in the past year and a half or so. So how could you maybe describe how the takeover of the Houthis of sort of central and parts of southern Yemen, outside of its normal area of operations and control in northern Yemen, affect AQAP militarily, but also in terms of its stature and potential recruitment base over the last year, year and a half or so?
The rise of the Houthis has been an incredible opportunity for AQAP. What many people don't realize is that AQAP has been targeting the al-Houthis, just the leadership, for years, and that actually began before the Arab Spring. And what we saw is as internal Yemenis realized that the Houthis were posturing for power in northern Yemen, AQAP was conducting some occasional asymmetrical attacks against checkpoints manned by the al-Houthis, particularly in al-Jawf, which is a northern eastern governorate in Yemen, and then was really just trying to disrupt operations. Once the Houthis took over Sana'a, that was a year ago, this week actually, and really started building a power base within the central government, AQAP took the fight to the Houthis and began targeting the al-Houthis in the same way for assassination as it was doing to the Yemeni military and security apparatus. So that includes targeting the al-Houthi officials in Sana'a and also in a governorate called al-Baida, which has been, you can describe it as the you know, main theater for AQAP against the al-Houthis in the central government today. I think that looking at recruitment, it's been a significant opportunity for al-Qaeda in Yemen, not because Yemenis identify along ideological lines, they really don't, but because it's been able to cast this fight in the sectarian terms that we've seen the region move into and to drive Yemen toward sectarianism. That's also been backed up by al-Houthi rhetoric, by Saudi Arabian rhetoric, and also by Iranian rhetoric. The key difference to think of today is that there is this popular mobilization against the al-Houthis and their allies within a primarily Sunni community. That's extremely different from what we saw in 2011 and 2012, where the population, there was a huge security vacuum, but the population itself wasn't mobilized fighting against another force. So AQAP has tapped into that today.
Speaking of the Saudis, obviously there's been the operation there, the war, however you want to describe it, since late March. How has AQAP been able to take advantage of what the Saudis, as well as the Emiratis and their coalition, have been doing in the air and now more on the ground recently, I guess in the past like 6-7 months?
The Saudi-led intervention has played in a very interesting manner on the ground. It's focused on defeating the al-Houthis, and when you look at how these actors are positioned and aligned on the ground, the al-Houthis and AQAP are really operating in different areas. AQAP is much more concentrated in East Yemen and is fighting against the al-Houthis along a front line that runs primarily, it's shifted a little bit recently, along the former boundaries of North and South Yemen. That's where the fight for the Saudis has been concentrated. They haven't been looking at where AQAP is. The place where AQAP has been able to take advantage of this is Saudi Arabia and other Arab allies have been arming local Yemeni popular militias. These are local militia forces that have been generated to fight against the al-Houthis. They've been armed, they've been funded by the Saudis and by other donors. In some cases, we've seen the weapons actually fall into AQAP hands. And you know, there's, of course, concerns that among the individuals trained by this Arab coalition are individuals linked to al-Qaeda. I think that is a tangential benefit. The biggest boon has been Saudi Arabia's entry into the war, and the Gulf state entry into the war really has changed the fundamental dynamics of the Yemeni conflict from one that is a Yemeni conflict to one that is based on the Saudi-Iran conflict, and it has moved attention away from what the United States or others should be doing about the growth of AQAP to how do we de-escalate this conflict and demobilize the al-Houthis in order to prevent this from spilling over into a regional conflict.
Yeah, definitely. Increasingly, a lot of the conflicts in the region seem to start falling down those lines once the proxies start, or I shouldn't say proxies, but, you know, Saudi and Iran doing what they're trying to do in the particular region, areas of the region, whether it's in Syria and Iraq or Yemen or Bahrain to a lesser extent. But drilling down further into more local level, we've seen AQAP doing a lot of local outreach, and you hear of these front groups like Abna Hadramaut or the Sons of Hadramaut and similar types of arrangements. We also saw previously in 2011, the AQAP created Ansar al-Sharia in Yemen, and now they're just calling it Ansar al-Sharia in the Arabian Peninsula as a front. Is what we're seeing with these sort of Abna and then particular region a similar type of action to what we saw when they created this Ansar al-Sharia front? Or is this a new type of outreach program to buy local and tribal support?
I think it's a little bit different than what we saw with Ansar al-Sharia. Ansar al-Sharia was designed simply to be another name for AQAP's insurgent forces on the ground, to introduce a little bit of disconnect between al-Qaeda and the fighter in front of you. The Sons of Hadramaut is much more oriented on a local level and is geared to providing local security. And I think that this might be a tactic that we see borrowed a little bit from what Jabhat al-Nusra has done in Syria, trying to instill itself in the governance systems and put people that may not be members of al-Qaeda or members of Jabhat al-Nusra into places where they are decision makers. And these would be those individuals who lean more along the Salafist spectrum and would be more likely to support al-Qaeda in the long term. Sons of Hadramaut is essentially a security organization operating out of Al-Mukalla Hadramaut. That's a port city in Yemen that AQAP has held since April. And it essentially provides the security alongside this council that's called the Hadramaut Domestic Council. You can translate that in various other ways, but that's how they've done their own translation of their name. And that's the council. It's composed of local Salafist sheikhs that provides governance and is really governing the city itself and the surrounding area. So I see this emergence much more as a way to integrate into governance rather than in 2011, where we saw Ansar Sharia, as a way to field an insurgent force.
That makes sense, definitely. But as we know, AQAP did have control over territory from sort of the spring 2011 to summer 2012. And now, as you mentioned, they're in control, along with these locals, of the fifth largest city, Al-Mukalla, and other parts of southern Yemen. How would you compare the way AQAP was structured or formed and in terms of the sort of social services and governance it was trying to provide when they're in control of territory in 2011 and 2012 to what we've been seeing more recently in the last half year with the governance in the areas that they control now?
It's been very different. And part of that is the circumstances. In 2011, of course, the central government had broken down, but a lot of the local governance remained. The areas where AQAP moved in 2011, Abyan in particular, there was insecurity already, and AQAP moved in primarily. It was able to provide justice and settle the local conflicts. What it did not do in 2011 was establish this sort of local council working with local power brokers in the same way that it's doing in Al-Mukalla today. So it was much easier for the Abiani tribes to organize around, and they actually established the same sort of popular militias that we're seeing today to fight off AQAP in 2011 and 2012. In Al-Mukalla, AQAP moved in, but it didn't take full control of the entire city the way that, and it moved in and it didn't take full control of the entire city, but it effectively started to control the decision-making and the disbursement of basic services. So those were still running, and it simply changed out the top-level command, and over time has made various changes to who controls the oil infrastructure in the city, for example, who's dispersing the payment for civilian government employees. That's all running through AQAP channels today, but it's primarily the same channel that was running previously, just with different people in place.
So it's more or less remained the same in terms of continuity of services and governance, or has it gotten worse, or do you think it's gotten better since sort of AQAP is pulling the strings?
It's been off and on, and right now we're in a place where there have been local demonstrations against AQAP in Al-Mukalla because the people are seeing the service provision as being spottier than it used to. I think it's a little spottier in most of Yemen, so it's not clear whether if the Yemeni government were in control of the city, it would be any better. But, you know, certainly AQAP is being challenged in meeting the basic demands on a regular basis in Al-Mukalla. It's interesting to see whether this opportunity will be exploited or not by the Saudi-led coalition or others in terms of separating AQAP from the population there. I think that one of the lessons learned from 2011 that has been fundamental in allowing AQAP to do what it does today is not to rapidly describe itself as the government and not to bring about the implementation of Sharia too quickly. So we have seen some instances of Sharia law being applied. primarily in regards to the use of khat and other drugs in Amukala. It's been floggings and public lashings, and it has not been along the lines of the HUD punishments, so the removal of hands for theft, etc. The only really violent act that I can recall besides the lashings was the crucifixion of two alleged Saudi spies after the death of AQAP's leader, Nasser Haishi, in June.
Yeah, definitely. It's interesting to see all this, you know, in terms of how Al-Qaeda has learned from their past experiences in governance. Obviously, we saw that sort of lessons learned paper that Wahashi sent along with a letter to Wadud and with AQIM in northern Mali. And then, of course, we've seen how Jabhat al-Nusra has sort of tried to work through the different alliances and factions in the Syrian context and and how now we're, I guess, seeing this play out in the Yemeni context as well again. So do you think that the local population will likely go against AQAP eventually in the same way that we saw a couple of years ago? Or do you think that AQAP has really embedded itself, ingratiated itself enough where they're seen as an important fabric of everyday life in the same way I think one could say in the case of northern Syria and Idlib with Jabhat al-Nusra has become?
I don't think we're to the case of Syria yet, where AQAP is fundamentally integrated into the fabric of society. But I do think the longer this goes on, it gives AQAP more opportunities. From listening to people who have contacts on the ground in Hadhramaut and listening to some of the decision-making that the local tribal leaders have made, there isn't a general acceptance of AQAP, but there is a bias towards stability. And many of these tribal leaders look at what's happening, especially there's this group that's operating out of Sayun, which is north of Al-Mukalla, and it's in Hadhramaut, a very powerful tribal grouping, historically anti-government, which is a problem in terms of working directly with the subnational actor for the United States and others because it empowers those outside of the central government. But they've been pushing for support to go against AQAP, will not do it without such support, without international backing, because it's a high cost to the tribe and kind of a low benefit afterward because you're still left with dealing with the population and managing the city. I think that when we're looking at how this plays out down the line, we'll find there's very little popular support for the group and its ideology, but the problem will be getting people to calculate that it's actually in their benefit to take up arms. You know, again, the 2011-2012 example is a prime one because the tribesmen there took up arms against AQAP, suffered significant casualties at the hands of the Ansar Sharia fighters on the ground, and then were effectively dismissed by the government because they weren't actual Yemeni security forces and they didn't receive that long-term support. And so you saw, even before the outbreak of the current crisis, AQAP was beginning to come back into that community because there was space. So I think a lot of people are looking for a long-term commitment and aren't seeing that.
Sounds just like Iraq. in relation to, obviously, the awakening and AQI, mm-hmm. and then the Iraqi government not, or Maliki's government not bringing these tribal figures into the political arena, the military, or security, essentially, having buy-in. And then, of course, we saw what happened with, ISI, ISIS, and then IS now in terms of how they're able to come back from 2012 until 2014. And, of course, everybody knows what happened since June last year in Mosul.
Mm-hmm. I think it's a key point to make, though, that it's a lot of the support isn't because of ideological reasons, but Al-Qaeda is a vector for others to use. So you see Ba'athists supporting ISIS in Iraq. And in Yemen, we've seen actors supporting AQAP simply because it's fighting the government and can meet their immediate demands.
Yeah, definitely. And we've seen that jihadists have been the ones to gain the most from these types of things in recent years, if not in the past as well. So one of the interesting things about what's been going on with AQAP, though, is that there's been a lot of deaths of their top leaders in the past year or half year or so. including Nizari, Rubaysh, Al-Ansi, Hatem, and of course Nasr al-Wahashi, the leader of the group. How do you think this has affected the organization? It seems that, at least in terms of the day-to-day stuff and their ability to operate, nothing's really changed.
I think that's a very fair observation. The current leader of AQAP was essentially the right hand of Nasr al-Wahashi. His name is Qasem al-Raimi. He was a military commander. He's been an active al-Qaeda, I would say, leader in Yemen for the past 10-odd years. And, you know, he's been vetted. He's bought onto the global jihad. He's the mastermind behind some of the attacks against the United States and has really been pushing the organization forward. I don't think we're looking at AQAP being decimated by the loss of its leadership. There is some question about losing so many leaders in such rapid succession, especially along the religious lines. When you name off the individuals who were killed, the majority of them were much more on the Sharia religious official side, and AQAP has certainly lost that grounding in terms of a voice based in the global jihad that can deliver fatwas and calls to arms to Yemeni Muslims. But of course, there are additional individuals rising up to the ranks, and I think that this isn't something that's going to hold back the organization long term.
Yeah, it's interesting, especially when you think of it in light of the potential competition from the Islamic State now entering inside of Yemen as well. Obviously, you know, we saw at first after, you know, the Islamic State, at least in the Iraqi context, taking over Mosul, that AQAP was sort of neutral on the whole war between ISIS and Jabhat al-Nusra, then Zawahiri and ISIS and everything related to that. But then, you know, the Islamic State announced the wilayats or the provinces inside of Yemen in mid-November last year. And we saw that AQAP obviously did not like that. And they put out a bunch of statements and videos in the end of November and December last year. And you know, they've had more of a anti-IS posture, I guess you could say, since then. And while we didn't really see too many activities from the Islamic State in Yemen for months after that original announcement, they first started doing some suicide attacks here and there. But now, at least in terms of their propaganda, they're trying to show that they're doing more activities in terms of military training, in terms of some dawah and things like that. Could you maybe talk a little bit about the entrance of the Islamic State into Yemen and what they've been up to specifically, as well as how this has affected AQAP?
It's actually been fascinating to watch. So Sharia, a cleric who was part of AQAP or leaned toward AQAP, he was killed, I think, in April or May of this year, along with other AQAP members. He had been a leading indicator of ISIS recruitment in Yemen, which we picked up a little bit after the fact. So he had initially come out in support of the Islamic State, and it was an interesting case. He ran a Twitter account, and within hours of putting out a tweet supportive of the Islamic State, that tweet was deleted from his account, which to me showed he was still part of AQAP, and that must have been a leadership decision. But he was from IB, and the initial recruits, so ISIS, the Islamic State, conducted a mass casualty attack in Sana'a on March 20th of this year with suicide bombers. I think four of the five named suicide bombers were from IB, which showed that there was some sort of local recruitment cell coming from that area. The reaction from AQAP, as you noted, has been really strong, and it's been emphasizing AQAP's strategy all along in Yemen, which has been to not kill civilians. When you look at AQAP's record, it's been pretty good at targeting Yemeni soldiers and security officials over the killing of civilians. It hasn't hit public places the way that ISIS strikes elsewhere. You know, there are a couple instances where AQAP may have crossed the line. I think most Yemenis would point to a December attack last year on the defense ministry complex in Sana'a, where a militant went through the hospital attached to that and killed individuals there. as being an attack against civilians, and there was significant backlash. But AQAP is focused on the fact that it's fighting the al-Houthis, that it's trying to unite the Sunnis against this al-Houthi threat, which, by the way, is backed by Saleh and his regime, and that the Saudis are, you know, also killing civilians in their airstrikes. So it's been trying to frame this entire fight as one in which AQAP has a set target set, and it's not moving beyond it. ISIS, meanwhile, as we've seen in Iraq and Syria, has a much broader target set, does not care about hitting mosques, and that has been its campaign really in Sana'a. It has about weekly detonated bombs targeting al-Houthi-linked mosques, described as Husseinias, which, you know, comes back to 12er Shiism and not Zaydi Shiism. But the interesting thing about what ISIS has done is it's not that powerful. It has named 8 wilayats in Yemen that I'm aware of, but they don't have a very strong ground force presence. They seem to be operating more along cells, you know, are much younger. They don't have the same sort of religious credentialed individuals that AQAP has, but very, very much benefiting from the chaos inside of the country.
Yeah, definitely. would you say that there's a bunch of overlap in terms of the areas of operation that the Islamic State and AQAP are located? Or are they sort of doing their own things independently in different areas of the country, whereby, it wouldn't necessarily cause any overt friction, whereas if they were, you know, operating in the same exact area, you might see internecine fighting in the same way we saw with Jabhat al-Nusra and the Islamic State when they first kicked off fighting against each other in January, February 2014.
The areas are beginning to overlap a little bit, but they remain fairly distinct. When ISIS first emerged, it came out and it's operating obviously in Sana'a, and then down in the south in Lahij and Aden, which are southern governorates. It's started initial incursions really into al-Bayda, that governorate that I mentioned in the beginning that has been at the forefront of AQAP's fight. But it hasn't been able to really field forces to create that ground conflict that you mentioned. I think the big difference that we need to think about here is that ISIS in Iraq and Syria fields an army. And in Yemen, it's a small cell of individuals who maybe place a bomb or fire a mortar shell. When you look at the attacks that ISIS has claimed in Yemen, they're very, very limited. Its activity in Shabwa governorate, for example, that's a governorate that's beginning to be on the eastern fringes of Yemen. You know, it claimed this grand attack in which it supported popular militias fighting against the al-Houthi-allied Yemeni military unit there. And what it claimed was a mortar shell that it fired against the base. That's not really a sign of strength to me. Of course, it's doing so to build up its credibility. And over the summer, I think toward the end of July or the beginning of August, we saw ISIS beginning to put out that it has, you know, pursued governance activities. So there's a picture set from Aden of an ISIS doctor apparently, applying treatment to a fighter. And then the other thing that's been interesting to watch has been the ISIS media groups in Shabwa and Hadramaut have been very reactive to kind of global ISIS initiatives. So the most recent one about the ISIS golden dinar, this is the currency of the Islamic State. We saw videos coming out from Yemen that supported the golden dinar at the same time as we saw them surfacing in other areas where ISIS is active.
Yeah, it's definitely been interesting to see this evolution and what they're trying to do. At least, for me so far, it seems like a lot of it's just sort of being stage managed or more sort of a way to project more power than they actually have right now. But we'll obviously see where this all, goes in the next half year and a half or so. Speaking of which, looking forward as it is, sort of what scenarios or trajectories or different things do you think you might see from AQAP, as well as the Islamic State in Yemen in, say, the next half year, year, 2 years going forward. I know that that's probably way too far in the future to predict maybe 2 years or a year and a half, just because everything changes every month or two these days in Yemen, as well as, you know, a lot of the other conflicts in the region nowadays. But maybe, you know, more near term, where do you see all of this going then?
Great question. Obviously, it's very contingent on how the war in Yemen develops. And this is something that I've said, you know, there is no military solution in Yemen. This has to be resolved on a political level, and that de-escalating the Yemeni conflict. This is the war between the al-Houthis and Saleh and President Hadi and the Saudis and the various southern militias that are fighting as well. Once that is de-escalated, that starts to create a problem for AQAP because the attention reverts back to the terrorism problem that Yemen has. I think that as long as we see this fight ongoing, AQAP will effectively have a green card to continue what it's doing. There may be problems in Amokala. We'll wait and see whether the opportunities to drive AQAP out of governance of the city will be exploited or not. It certainly has consolidated control in other spaces in Yemen and is inching its way, you know, back toward what it had in 2011 and 2012, adding on the port city. I don't really see that changing too much. I think it's going to continue to try to train Sunni fighters. You know, there was a video that was put out in August where it explicitly noted it's been training tribesmen, sending them weapons, and effectively attempting to coordinate their fight against the al-Houthis. That's an effort I don't see going away. I also don't see AQAP doing too much to raise the alarm about what's going on in Yemen. It's benefiting right now from the fact that the United States is overwhelmed. AQAP probably remains the most dangerous al-Qaeda group and or direct threat to the United States versus the other ones. But I don't think that a terrorist attack will work to its benefit because that draws the United States directly back into the Yemeni conflict. Whereas right now there is some agreement that this is going to be a Saudi-run problem. That being said, I don't think that we can dismiss this now as just a local threat. AQAP is setting the stage for something big. We need to be looking out a year or two and what al-Qaeda could have in Yemen come the next paradigm shift. Some items to note would be that Ibrahim al-Assiri, the bomb maker from AQAP who designed the underwear bomb, who designed the printer cartridge bombs, he's still active. He's trained other individuals, and I think that we're likely to see them continue their research and development in this safe haven that they've carved out for themselves in order to have a higher or to pack up higher punch come the future. I also think that they're going to continue to support what's happening in Syria. This is something that sometimes gets missed when you're looking at al-Qaeda affiliate by affiliate or branch by branch. Al-Qaeda is a global organization too. It does have some sort of central command. Ayman al-Zawahiri recently emerged after about a year of silence and has begun issuing public directives to the affiliates and is trying to coordinate their activities. Syria remains the top priority for al-Qaeda. It is where it has the strongest al-Qaeda affiliate on the ground, the best chance of building up what could be a rival to the Islamic State. I think that, you know, we're facing challenges in Afghanistan and Pakistan, and really focusing efforts on supporting and not losing in Syria is going to be a long-term effort for al-Qaeda.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. You don't foresee sort of a Mosul moment happening in the Yemeni context with AQAP, with them, you know, all of a sudden maybe taking over Aden or something along those lines in the near term?
There have been whispers about AQAP working in Aden. It's you know, obviously very hard to determine whether it's AQAP or just some other individuals. I guess I don't see AQAP taking the full port city at this point. We have the Emirati forces there. We have Saudi forces there. Southerners who really aren't that welcoming to the al-Qaeda ideology are operating there. Granted that that mix means that Aden is actually an ungoverned city. I think that what you could see would be AQAP refocusing its attention on Aden and you know, as the Yemeni government returns to Aden and tries to reconstitute itself, this is the Hadi-led government, tries to reconstitute itself and reestablish authority, it's a prime target for AQAP. If they were able to take out the cabinet members, you know, I'm not really sure what you're left with when you're looking at the government that's opposed to the al-Houthis.
Yeah, and just one final question related to everything. You know, you talked about how there isn't, you know, a military solution to this, that the forces on the ground, the different actors, they need to come up with some type of political settlement. At this point right now, do you foresee these various actors having the incentive or interest in wanting to do that? Or do many of them view whom they're going against right now as more of an existential threat, and therefore they don't feel that they can give up the fight, and therefore this is likely to go on longer because of this? Sort of like we've seen all these times of the various factions in the Libyan context trying to work something out politically, but because they all have different interests, or they feel that they can't give up the fight, otherwise they'll lose out, they just continue even if it makes the situation worse.
I think that what we've seen is that there is a general agreement among the Yemeni actors as to what a negotiated settlement would look like. The problem has been the initial terms and the fact that, you know, I believe with Hadi's government receiving direct support from Saudi Arabia, Saudi Arabia now has a shot to call in the negotiations, which has extended them over fears, of course, that Iran would gain unwilling influence in Iran, in Yemen through the Houthis. So I think that there is a negotiated settlement to be had. I don't think that it's just amongst the Yemeni actors at this point. I think that there needs to be some concept from the Saudis and the Gulf states and Iran as to what would be acceptable in Yemen, and that the Yemeni actors would then be left to their own devices to figure out how to make that happen. And of course, it needs to come down to the local level because, you know, with all of these conflicts, we, the international community, focus entirely on these national level actors who, at the end of the day, don't hold all of the power on the ground. Hadi has a very, very small constituency. His return to Yemen is interesting because many of the supporters for Hadi are supporting him because he's opposed to the al-Houthis, not because they genuinely want him and his government to come back to power. So I think that this is going to be a multi-phased process moving forward.
Yeah, we'll see what happens, I suppose. But thanks for coming onto the show. I really appreciate you taking the time and providing some really great insights and granularity to the analysis on the situation.
It's my pleasure, Aaron.
This episode's hashtag social media segment will cover postings between September 17th and the 27th.
During that time span, 13 foreign fighters were killed with various groups in Syria, while 9 were killed with the Islamic State in Iraq. Also during that time period, AQAP conducted 10 military operations.
On September 17th, Wilayat al-Farat of the Islamic State throws gay individuals off the roof for sodomy.
On September 18th, Jabhat al-Nusra caught and destroyed a shipment of cigarettes in Jisr al-Shagur, Syria, as part of a campaign to prohibit it.
On September 19th, the Islamic State releases its official calendar for the Islamic month of Dhu al-Hijjah.
Also on the 19th, Wilayat al-Raqqa of the Islamic State shows off its carbonated beverages factory in al-Raqqa City.
On September 20th, Wilayat al-Farat of the Islamic State had its final exams for the Sharia course for its imams and preachers in al-Wasat district.
Also on September 20th, Wilayat al-Barqa of the Islamic State shows off its growing of vegetables and fruits in Harawa, Libya and Dara, Libya.
Also on the 20th, Wilayat al-Farat of the Islamic State builds a clock tower for the town of Abu Kamal, Syria.
On the 20th as well, Wilayat Halab of the Islamic State manufactures water reservoir tanks.
On September 21st, Wilayat Kirkuk of the Islamic State shows off its brick factory in Al-Hawija, Iraq.
Also on the 21st, Wilayat Hama of the Islamic State trains an expeditionary regiment.
On September the 22nd, supporters of the Islamic State in the Philippines release a series of photos hoping to prove themselves.
September 23rd, Ansar al-Sharia Libya shows off the sacrificial animals it got for residents and the needy in Ajdabiya and Benghazi for Eid al-Adha.
Also on the 23rd, AQAP's Hizba Center destroyed tombs in al-Mukalla, Hadramaut, Yemen.
On the 23rd, we light Hadramaut of the Islamic State teaches first aid to its soldiers to use in the field.
On September 24th, the Islamic Emirate of the Caucasus in al-Sham celebrates Eid al-Adha and provides sacrificial animals to its fighters and civilians.
On September 25th, Jabhat Ansar al-Din prepares sacrificial animals in Aleppo, Syria for residents and its fighters for Eid al-Adha.
Also on the 25th, Harakat al-Shabaab al-Mujahideen holds prayers for Eid al-Adha in the city of Janali in Wilayat Lower Shabelle and the city of Jilib in Wilayat Juba in Somalia.
Also on the 25th, Jabhat al-Nusra celebrates Eid al-Adha in Jabal Akrad, Western al-Ghouta, Dara, al-Kunaitra, Aleppo, Jabal al-Zawiya, Abu Zuhur, Bustan al-Qasr, among other places.
On September 25th, Jabhat al-Nusra holds a new military training camp in rural Latakia.
On September 26th, Katibat Uqba'a bin Nafi shows off its Eid al-Adha celebrations in Jebel Shamdi in western Tunisia, despite the Tunisian military bombing them.
On September 27th, Ansar al-Islam in Syria celebrates Eid al-Adha in Aleppo and Idlib.
And on the 27th as well, Wilayat al-Anbar of the Islamic State demolished the Abdullah bin al-Mubarak shrine in Al-Hit, Iraq.
If you have any feedback, you can email us, podcast@jihadology.net, or you can find us on Twitter where we are @jihadpod. As we mentioned on the last episode, the podcast is now available on Stitcher, and if you're a fan of the podcast, please consider taking a moment to rate and review the show, whether that's in iTunes or Stitcher or wherever you find the show, because that'll help more people find the program.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Jihadology podcast. Thanks to Catherine for coming onto the show and sharing her expertise with us. Also, thanks to the podmaster, Carl Moran, for making sure this podcast sounds and runs smoothly. Until next time, I'm out.